Now, I think for once I'm ready to start on time, so I'm going to begin. And I want to talk today about transport. We're going to start by talking about how you measure transport and then how you use those measurements to decide what kind of transport you're dealing with. And then at the end, we're going to talk, I hope if we have time, about how you put it all together to actually move something around. And if we don't have time to do that, we'll do it next time. So, you may remember that last time we talked about the various types of transport, and I just put this up here for review. You don't really need 4B for the moment, but to remind you that you either need a protein for transport or you don't. If you don't, that's case one, simple diffusion. If you need a protein, it's either a channel-type protein or a transporter. If it's a transporter, it either transports things down their gradient or up their gradient, and if it transports them up the gradient, it either does that by primary active transport at the expense of ATP or by secondary active transport at the expense of something else. So what we want to do today is consider how you tell all those apart, what are their features. And we said at the end of class last time how you measure transport. That what you do is you start out with cells, or in this case, red blood cell ghosts are even easier to use. And you put them in a solution, and you start out so that there is no X inside, but there is X in the solution. And what we're measuring this time is the reaction X out to X in. We have a membrane, and we want to know how much X has gone in. And so that's easy to tell, because at various time points, you take a sample of the solution, you use a centrifuge or a filter to separate the cells from the liquid, and then you measure the amount of X, which is associated with the cells, which is inside. So you can measure the amount of X inside with time. So the kind of curves you get are shown on 4C. On 4C, there are two sets of curves. And in your notes, these are referred to as curve 1 and curve 2. This is curve 1 and curve 2. So we're going to just talk about curve 1 first, and then we'll get to 2. Now, in all three of these curves, what you're looking at is the concentration inside as a function of time. Now, you notice that no matter what happens, the curve flattens out. Because at first, there's a very high concentration outside and nothing inside, so material moves in. So with time, you get more and more stuff inside. But eventually, you reach an equilibrium where the concentration inside balances the concentration outside. Now, what we mean by equilibrium is not that stuff isn't moving anymore, but the rate of stuff moving out is balanced by the rate of moving in. In the beginning, stuff is moving only in. But when you reach equilibrium, the rate out equals the rate in. Now, if we're dealing, there are two possibilities here. And for everything we're talking about now, we're talking about neutral compounds. What we'll do if the compounds aren't neutral, we'll get to later. Now, usually one of two things happens. One possibility is that when you reach a balance, the concentration inside equals the concentration outside. Now, that means that you have a situation here where it is actually the concentration of X which is driving transport. This is passive transport. When the X is higher out here, you get transport in. But once the X gets higher inside, you get transport out, until eventually the levels on the two sides balance out, the transport in the two directions balances out. So in a case of passive transport, when you reach a balance, the concentration in and out is going to be the same. And that's the way these first two curves look. Now, as it says on your handout, the first case is simple diffusion, case one. And the second case is facilitated diffusion, by which they mean carrier-mediated, or case two. Excuse me, case three, not case two. By which they mean case three, passive transport, but using a carrier protein. And in both of these cases, since they're passive transport, you reach a balance or an equilibrium when the concentration inside-outside is equal. But there are times when you reach a balance, the concentration inside is actually higher than the concentration outside. Now, what does that mean? That means that X has been pushed against its gradient until the concentration is higher inside. That's if we're measuring transport inside. We could be measuring transport in the other direction. Things have to get out of cells just as they have to get into cells. But the point here is that if you have some energy driving, providing reaction pushing X, then you can get more X on one side than you have on the other. That, in fact, is what happens in active transport. Whether it's primary or secondary, with active transport, you end up with more X on one side than you have on the other. So that's why the third case is active transport. Now, why do you eventually reach a balance? If you're pushing X, why doesn't it just keep going? Think about what happens with a real pump. As you pump, say, the water up to the top of your building, you have a certain amount of force that the pump exerts to push the water. But as the water piles up on the top of your building, the pressure of the water to leak down begins to get higher and higher. And you eventually reach a balance where the pump force up is balanced by the pressure down, and you can't pump anymore. So even though you're pushing, you have a finite limit to how hard you can push, and eventually the force of the X coming back balances it. So you reach a point then at which the push out equals the push in. But the push in is your energy driving reaction, energy providing reaction, and the push out is the concentration of X. Okay, so by looking at curve one, you can tell, in fact, whether you're dealing with active transport, four and five, or passive transport, the other cases. So now I have a question for you. Suppose we did our experiment all over again. Now, the first time we did it, we started with some concentration of X, and we measured the amount of X inside at increasing times. Now, so this is number one. So suppose we do it again, but the X on the outside to start is higher. So we use a concentration of X on the outside, which is greater than in number one. In other words, there's more X in here. And we do the same experiment over again. We start out with more X outside, and with time, we take samples and we measure the amount of X inside. If we plot that up, what will it look like? Let's stick to, say, this case. We have carrier-mediated transport, but we've got more X outside to start with. Will we get the same slope? And will it plateau at the same point? So I'm going to give you a minute, and then we'll take a vote. So you can think about it, discuss it with your neighbor, see what you think. If we have a higher concentration of X, what will happen to the uptake with time? Slope the same? Plateau point the same or not? Thank you. They get 5 seconds. Okay, so let's take a vote. We have more x. What about the slope? Now, everybody knows it won't go down. So the question is, will it be the same or will it go up? So the same, go up, undecided. So we have a few undecided, we have a significant number of the same, and we have a lot of go up. So why would it stay the same? Does anyone want to defend that one? Yeah, explain your reasoning. You have the same number of carriers. But what is the limiting factor here? Is it the number of carriers or is it the supply of X? Well, it's going to depend. If you don't have very much X to start with and you add more X, then if you don't have very much X to start with, most of the carriers aren't busy. Those that are moving X. Now you add more X. More carriers are busy, and so you move more X in. So if you didn't have very much X to begin with, and you raise the amount of X, what's going to happen? Well, maybe I should say it the other way. He's saying if you have a lot of X already, and the carriers are working as fast as they can, and you add more X, it doesn't make any difference. So in fact, you're both right. If you have a lot of X, and you've already saturated your carriers, more X doesn't help. But if you have a little X, and some of them weren't busy, and you add more X, then it will go faster. So in fact, if I didn't have too much X to begin with, and I got this curve, and now I started with more X, it would look like this. And if I added even more X, it would look like this. But if I add even more X, it won't go any faster because it's already all the carriers are busy and it's going as fast as it can. And in fact, the way you get this curve, curve number two, is notice you're measuring the rate of uptake, which is the slope of curve one, as a function of how much X you had outside. So this is the same as increasing X. As you increase the X outside, what happens to the rate of uptake? It goes faster and faster and faster until all the carriers are busy. And then adding more X doesn't help. Another way of thinking about that is we're looking at this. The transporter can be thought of as an enzyme, which is catalyzing X out to X in. And in that case, that's just the V versus S curve. That's a velocity of reaction versus amount of substrate. Now, what's substrate? X outside. So the more X outside you add, the faster it goes until all the enzyme is working as fast as it can. Except here, the enzyme is a transporter protein. Okay, well, while we're at it, what's going to happen at the balance point? When you finally, it's going to plateau. When it plateaus, will the inside concentration equal the outside? For this case, it always does. But if you started with more on the outside, then the plateau is going to be higher. It's still going to be inside equals outside, but those values are going to be larger. So in fact, it's going to be this. It's going to be like that. So you actually are going to get a higher plateau value. The more you start with, when you reach the balance, the higher the value is. Now you notice that active transport looks exactly the same for curve number two. Curve number one, curve number two, why do they look the same? In both cases, you have a carrier protein acting like an enzyme. And the more stuff you have for it to move, the faster it moves it. Until the point when all your carriers are working full time. So whether you have passive transport or active transport, in both cases, you have a protein whose capacity is limited. So in both cases, the curve plateaus. In other words, transport saturates. The rate reaches a max, just like an enzyme reaction reaches a Vmax. And you can measure a Vmax and a Km for the transporter or enzyme protein. Why does this one look different? This is simple diffusion. That means, what protein are we using here? ZipO, none. So since there is no protein, the only limiting factor is the concentration of X. So the more X you add, the faster the transport is. Now, the actual rate is probably quite slow. If we really drew these on the right scale, enzymes and transporters speed up transport enormously. So this rate could be quite slow. It would depend what it is, what's moving. But if you have no transport protein, then you don't get saturation of transport. Now, you notice that we've got the case here for one, no protein. We've got it for facilitated diffusion with a carrier, and we've got it for active transport. We haven't put in channels, because channels were discovered later, and it's not exactly clear how to fit them in here. Let me say the short answer, that with a channel, the curve looks more like this one. And that is, at reasonable levels of X, the channel doesn't saturate. However, if you add enormous amounts of X, the channel does saturate. Things are moving through as fast as they possibly can, and adding more stuff doesn't matter. But what I want to do now, let's just summarize the difference here, between the two curves, and then look at each individual case more carefully. In the top curve, you're measuring the concentration inside with time. And the slope of this line is the rate of uptake. And they always level off. But the question is, do they level off with concentration inside and outside equal or not? Now, the second curve, on the other hand, is measuring the rate or slope of the upper curve with different values of X outside, different outside concentrations. And that only saturates if there is an enzyme or a carrier protein that has to change conformation for this reaction to work, for this transport to work. Okay. So let's look at the, let me ask if there are any questions before we look at the individual cases. Okay, let's look at the cases because I think it'll make it clearer. So let's go back and look at simple diffusion. This is passive transport. So at equilibrium, the concentration inside equals out. And there's no protein to saturate, so the more stuff outside you have, the faster it goes. Now, how can you define this in terms of equilibria and delta Gs, the way we did last time? If you just think of this as a reaction, except this time, there's no enzyme. We're just talking about X in going to X out. What is the equilibrium constant for this reaction in the case of simple diffusion? Remember, the equilibrium constant is the ratio of the product to the reactant at equilibrium. So at equilibrium, how is X out related to X in? It's the same. So the equilibrium constant is 1. The delta G0 is 0. Another way of saying that is this is one of those reactions where it's the concentration of X that pushes it. If you have more X on this side, it goes that way. If you have more X on the other side, it goes this way. Okay, so this diffusion through a membrane without a protein is in fact reversible, and which way the substance goes depends on the concentration. Now, what significance is this? When does such a thing ever happen? When does the fusion across a membrane ever occur? I think we mentioned before that gases can diffuse across membranes. This is very important in getting the CO2 out of your body and the out of your cells and the oxygen in. Gases can diffuse, and very small neutral molecules can diffuse, but the really important ones are gases and hydrophobic molecules. And the most interesting hydrophobic molecules that diffuse across membranes are hormones. There are a bunch of lipid and lipid-like hormones, and they can diffuse across membranes into their target cell and get some action. And how that works, we will return to. So the two big things here that use simple diffusion are gases and certain steroid or steroid-like hormones. Now we're going to meet another case of diffusion which is important, but it's not diffusion across a membrane. It turns out that in your blood vessels, we tend to think of them as solid, but they're actually surrounded by cells. And those cells are not tightly joined. So people sometimes draw it like this. So this is a cross section. These are the cells that are really going around and forming the wall of the blood vessel. These are called endothelial cells. They're a kind of epithelium. But the point notice here is they're not tightly joined. Since they're not tightly joined, it means that material can diffuse through the liquid in the spaces between the cells. Now we have no membrane. We're just diffusing through liquid. So small molecules can diffuse in and out of your blood vessels. Proteins are too big, but small molecules can go in and out. And we'll get to an example of next time, of how important this is in getting glucose from your gut to your cells. Now, this is all I want to say about simple diffusion, and now I want to talk about facilitated diffusion. So I want to go from case 1 to case 3. As I said, case 2 was discovered last, and I'm going to talk about it last. But before we leave case 1, are there any questions? Yeah?
I think the book mentions something about water being able to diffuse through membranes.
Most membranes are permeable to water, but the rate of water transport through them is very slow. And so membranes that transport a lot of water have channels for water called aquaporins. Okay, so let's move on now to this case, carrier-mediated transport, usually called facilitated diffusion, or to be absolutely clear, you don't mean a channel, facilitated diffusion using a carrier. Now, we're talking here about neutral substances. And so notice these two curves look the same. Whether you have no protein or whether you have a carrier protein, we're talking about X moving down its gradient. X is moving from where it's high to where it's low. Now, in one case, it requires no protein to do that. But in many cases, a protein is required. For example, glucose cannot get across a membrane. Without a carrier. But even with a carrier protein of type 3, it moves always from where it's higher to where it's lower. But the protein helps it move. The protein makes like a hydrophilic door or through the membrane so that the substance can move. But since glucose is just going down its gradient, it means that this reaction is reversible. There's more glucose on this side, the door can be used this way. And if there's more glucose on this side, the door can be used that way. Now, one analogy to this is a revolving door. If you consider a revolving door to, say, a large apartment house or a business, at one time of day in the morning, people go in one direction through that door on average. And at the other end of the day, people use the same door in large numbers to go in the opposite direction. And it's the press of people or the concentration of X which determines which way the door is used. Another way of thinking about a carrier is that it's something like a swinging door. Something like this. One of the books calls it the rocking banana model because the proteins shape more like this. So it can be like this, it can be like this, or like this. Now, if you happen to have a lot of glucose on this side, it tends to get trapped and pushed that way. If you happen to have a lot of glucose on this side, it tends to get trapped and pushed this way. It's analogous to the revolving door. The carrier protein enables X to move in the direction favored by the gradient of X. So curve number one is the same for whether you have a protein or carrier-mediated transport. But curve number two is different. Because in the case of a carrier protein, there's a protein. And you can saturate that protein. You can add so much X that the protein molecules are all busy. Now, this is analogous to consider the revolving door. If you have enough people present, they have to wait to get through the revolving door. The rate at which people go through the door is limited. If there are only a few people, then more people pass through per hour. But this is when the revolving door is at maximum capacity and the number of people who move through per day, per minute is really reached a limit. So you can measure for a carrier, a Vmax, a Km, etc., just as you can for an enzyme. As people sometimes call a carrier protein of this kind a permease, to emphasize that it acts like an enzyme, that's the ACE part, and that it catalyzes permeation of the membrane, or this is the reaction. Now the energy considerations, delta G, etc., is the same, K equilibrium, is the same for both case one and case three. Now I want to talk a little bit about how transport by such a carrier is regulated. Of course, it's regulated to some extent by the concentration of X. But is there any other way of regulating how effective the carrier is at moving X across a membrane? And I want to talk about three kinds of regulation. One we've already talked about, and that's allosteric feedback. Or allosteric regulation. One is covalent modification. And the third is insertion into the membrane. Now the top two can be used to regulate the activity of any particular protein. Now notice I said activity. We're not talking about changing the amount of a protein. That's important too. But we're saying if a cell has a fixed amount of protein, can you make it work better or worse? So one way is by allosteric regulation. We talked about this last semester. Small molecules bind to your protein, change its conformation a little, and it works better, it works worse. So we're not going to talk about the details of that. We understand that. Now, what do I mean by covalent modification? This happens in prokaryotes, but it's a much bigger deal in eukaryotes. Many proteins are modified by the addition of small things, sugars, phosphates, other small proteins. And this is often reversible because one enzyme puts the whatever it is on and another enzyme takes whatever it is off. So this is not reversible like an allosteric interaction, which involves only weak bonds. This involves strong bonds. So you need an enzyme to make them and an enzyme to take them off. Now, many proteins, not just membrane proteins, are activated and deactivated in this way. And that's one of the reasons for bringing it up. We will meet many, many examples of this. The third method only works for membrane proteins, as we'll explain in a minute. Now, what's an example of a covalent modification? The most famous and well-known one is the addition of phosphate. That is the most famous reversible one. We've already mentioned that many proteins have carbohydrate short sugar chains attached to them. That is generally not reversible. Once the sugar is added, it stays. But the phosphate business is often reversible. So what we're saying is you have some protein, which we've called X here. I probably shouldn't call it just X because we mean a protein here. So we'll call it protein X. And you have ATP. And the terminal phosphate of ATP is added to the protein. It's added to the side chain of one of the amino acids. So now we have a phosphate on the X and ADP. Now, this reaction requires an enzyme, and any enzyme that takes a phosphate off of ATP and puts it onto something is called a kinase. This would be a protein kinase because it takes the phosphate off ATP and puts it on a protein. And this reaction is usually irreversible. Why? What do you think delta G zero of this reaction is? Positive, negative, or zero?
Positive.
How many people think it's zero? Positive. Negative. Well, the majority is negative, although I can see some of you are not sure or not willing to venture. It's actually negative because the energy you get from breaking off the N-phosphate is greater than the energy you need to attach the phosphate. This is usually irreversible. But there's another enzyme that takes the protein-phosphate combination and hydrolyzes off the phosphate. So it adds water across that bond and gives you X, an inorganic phosphate. Maybe I should probably write protein X to be sure we know. Now, any enzyme that hydrolyzes off a phosphate is called a phosphatase. And this is a protein phosphatase. Cells contain a large collection of protein kinases and protein phosphatases, and it's the balance between their activities is often very, very important. Many signals activate one or the other. Needless to say, you don't want to activate both of them, because then you have a short circuit. You put the phosphate on, you take it off, you put the phosphate on, you take it off. So at any one time, you want to do one or the other. Now, notice that each of these reactions is irreversible. Strictly speaking, they're both delta G0 negative, and they almost always run in the same direction. But between the two of them, you can put the phosphate on the protein and take the phosphate off. Some proteins are active when phosphorylated and inactive when not. Some proteins are the other way around. Okay, so we'll meet an example of this later today of how putting a phosphate on and taking it off changes the activity of an important protein. But I want to consider now this third mechanism, which is unique to transmembrane proteins. And that is, if you have a protein, you can either put it into the membrane or take it out of the membrane. And that, of course, it changes what it can do. So today we're talking about transport proteins, but it applies to other transmembrane proteins as well. But the most famous examples involve transport. Now, what are we talking about here? You need to draw a diagram. When a transmembrane protein is first made in a cell, it is actually inserted into the membrane of a vesicle. So the protein would be like this. This is a single-pass protein. If it were a multi-pass protein, it would look like a little different, maybe like this. But but the protein is inserted into the membrane. And in this case, we want to consider a transport or a channel protein, so we'll draw it like this. It has some space through which things can move. Now, this is a vesicle. How the protein gets into the vesicle, we will explain. But we have here then a layer of membrane with a lumen inside. Now, remember we talked about vesicle fusion? A vesicle can fuse with a membrane. So this vesicle can fuse with the plasma membrane. So the vesicle would be, say, here. Here's the plasma membrane. I'm going to put my channel over here. My channel, this works, there are many cases of this known involving either channels or transporters. Cases 2 or 3. I don't know of any cases involving 4 or 5, although there may be some. So then what happens is we have a fusion of the two membranes. This is like exocytosis, and our channel is here. And now we have, when the membrane straightens out, our channel or transporter is now in the membrane. Now, what's the difference? Over here, if they think of this as being a revolving door, the revolving door is where it is non-functional. It's not doing anybody any good. We have a solid wall. But over here at the end, the revolving door has actually been pushed into the wall. And we have a door and things can move in and out. Now this process is reversible. So you can have endocytosis. The membrane deforms. The vesicle forms. And the vesicle pulls away from the membrane. So this method can be used to essentially insert a door or a channel into the membrane or to take it away. There's an equivalent to this. How many of you have ever seen Fawlty Towers? Well, if you haven't, you should. It's a British sitcom, and it's about this impossible hotel you would never want to visit. And there is this nudnik who works there called Manuel. And they do some repairs, and they move the door. And Manuel takes his platter, and he walks up to the wall where the door should be, and bonk. No door. You can't get through. And this is exactly what's happened here. You took away the door. There may be some glucose over here. There may be some glucose over there, but it can't get through. No door. So there are two famous examples of this process. One involves the glucose transporter, which is called GLUT4. This is a carrier which facilitates the movement of glucose down its own gradient. So this is a carrier. The name stands for glucose transporter number 4. There are a bunch of similar ones, as we'll explain later. So this particular one responds to insulin. In some cells, primarily in adipose tissue and in muscle. That's fat tissue and muscle. This protein sits in a vesicle. When insulin comes along, the vesicle fuses with the membrane. There is now a transporter, and glucose can enter the cell. In the absence of insulin, the protein is withdrawn and glucose cannot enter the cell. Some cells have a transporter that's there all the time. Your brain has a transporter that's always there. You always need glucose in your brain, no question. But you only need to take up glucose, say, into your muscle when you've eaten a lot and there's a lot floating around. And so insulin is the trigger to move this transporter in and out. And that's what's so serious about diabetes. In diabetes type 1, there is no insulin. In diabetes type 2, there is no response to insulin. So if the insulin doesn't work, you can't put the transporter in your membrane, and you can't take glucose up into these two kinds of cells. And so they are essentially starved. Now, another example involves not a carrier protein, but a channel protein. We mentioned that some cells have channels for water that are called aquaporins. From the name. These are water channels, and they are found very prominently in parts of the kidney. And they also respond to a hormone. They respond to the hormone ADH, which is antidiuretic hormone. We'll talk more about it later when we get to the kidney. But ADH governs the insertion of this protein into the membrane. If this protein is in the membrane, water can pass through it into the body and be retained. If this protein is not in the membrane, water goes out in the urine. So we have two cases here of hormones, insulin and ADH, that regulate the insertion of a door essentially into or out of a membrane. Now, this is the interesting feature of carrier-mediated transport that I wanted to talk about. And now I want to talk about active transport. But let's ask first if there are questions about this. Yes?
Can you reiterate the feedback for loop 4 in the presence of insulin?
Which way does it go?
Right, so
the way it goes is insulin pushes it this way. So insulin favors insertion into the membrane. Well, I wouldn't call this positive or negative. When we get to homeostasis, I'll explain how those terms are used in a physiological context. But I think it's better not to call this either one. Not to call it positive or negative feedback. But to consider it that insulin triggers the conditions for the uptake of glucose. Yeah?
Will these proteins be made on the rough endoplasmic reticulum?
Would these proteins be made on the rough endoplasmic reticulum? All transmembrane proteins are, and we'll explain how that works probably next time or the time after. Other questions? Okay. So the two cases we've talked about so far involve passive transport. What is pushing X is the concentration of X. But now in active transport, something else is pushing the X around as well. And we want to talk about that next. Now, I think it's easier if we draw something we had on the board last time for active transport. With active transport, you have X on one side and X on the other, and we always talked about in going to out, although there's some cases which are the reverse. You have a process that has a negative delta G that generates energy, and it either pushes the X in or the X out. Now, I think I should write this the other way because that's the way we've been doing it. X out on the left. So this process is coupled to an energy-yielding reaction. And the cases we've been discussing, they're pushing X out into in. So in primary active transport, this is simply the hydrolysis of ATP. But in secondary active transport, the process that yields the energy is something else, and it's usually an ion going down its gradient, often sodium. So sodium goes from where it's high to where it's low. Now, it doesn't have to be sodium, but it often is. So let's write sodium or other ion. Now, in both of these cases, you have a transport protein involved, and therefore, the transport protein, as you add more and more X, you can saturate the transport protein, and it can work as fast as it can, and so curve 2 saturates, just like in passive transport. But what about energy relationships and curve 1? For this coupled reaction, what is the delta G? Well, I just said. But what is the delta G zero for this reaction? The combination is virtually always negative. So delta G zero is very negative. So delta G is usually negative no matter what the concentrations are. So this almost always goes in the same direction. Similarly, for secondary active transport, for the coupled reaction, delta G zero is quite negative. So delta G is always negative. So what about the equilibrium constant? At equilibrium, do you expect equal amounts of X on the two sides? The whole point of this is no. The equilibrium constant is actually going to be greater than 1. You're going to have more product or X pushed in the appropriate direction than X on the other side. How do you know whether you have a case of primary or secondary active transport? Now let's consider an example. If we bring our epithelial cells back again, if this is the lumen of your intestine, there's glucose in what you just ate. Let's say you just OD'd on candy or something. So there's glucose here. So the glucose has to be transported into these epithelial cells. Because remember we said last time it can't go in between because of the tight junctions. So the glucose has to go in the apical side and out the basolateral. So how is the glucose going to get into your cells? Most of the time, depending on what you ate, the glucose concentration in your intestine is actually lower than the glucose concentration in the cells. So the glucose has to be pushed or pumped from the intestine into your cells. And the question is, so something's pushing it. Is this primary active transport or secondary active transport? So let me ask you a question. What would happen if everything ran out of ATP? If I measured transport across this top membrane, this apical membrane, and there was no ATP in the cells at all, would transport happen or not? What would happen to transport? Is it different? How could you tell whether I'm dealing with primary or with secondary? So I want you to think about this for a minute. Glucose is the X here. Glucose is going into those cells. It's either doing it this way or it's doing it this way. If there's no ATP, what will happen? Will glucose, will transport slow down? Will it stop? Will it stop right away? Will it stop in a while? What's the difference between 1 and 2? Yeah, do you have a question?
But don't you need ATP for the sodium and potassium?
Don't you need ATP to establish this gradient in the first place? Yes, you do. Most primary active transport involves ions. So primary active transport is needed to set up this gradient. But now suppose we shut off the ATP. Will either of these stop immediately? So I want you to think about, or both, neither. Think about that for a minute. Maybe discuss it. Will active transport of both kinds stop immediately or not? So let's look at this one. If there's no more ATP, will this one stop right away? Yes, it seems clear. This one will stop immediately. If there's no more ATP, will this one stop immediately? And the answer is no, because we've got already established sodium gradient. Now, will this go on forever? No. What will happen? The sodium gradient will run down. And once the sodium gradient runs down, then transport will stop. Now, why doesn't it normally stop? In a normal cell, primary active transport is re-establishing the gradient. And then the gradient is being used for secondary active transport. So the pump which establishes this gradient, is running in the back of this background, so to speak, all the time. A little bit of sodium rundowns its gradient, the pump pushes it back up. When you turn off the pump, you have the gradient. The water is already at the top of the dam. But once all the water comes down from the top of your building to your faucet, there's no more pump to put the water back up again. So secondary active transport can continue for a while without ATP, but not indefinitely. And this is one of the major ways of telling the two of them apart. What happens if you mess with the ATP supply or the ATP generation? Now, we've mentioned here two types of active transport, primary and secondary. Secondary active transport is actually how glucose gets into the epithelial cells. And this is with sodium. It's called sodium glucose co-transport. And this requires a different protein than than a glucose transporter. This is a glucose sodium co-transporter, which is a different protein that works in a different way. And the two of them flow in the same direction. Now, why would that be? If sodium is flowing down its gradient, the sodium outside cells is always higher than the sodium inside. Now, why is the sodium outside higher? That's because of the pump we talked about last time, the sodium-potassium pump. Sodium-glucose co-transport is an example of secondary active transport. The sodium-potassium pump is an example of primary active transport. ATP is split to move sodium out and potassium in. Now, the sodium and glucose move in the same way, so that's symport. But the sodium and the potassium move in opposite directions, so that's antiport. And one of the things I want to do today is look at the model for those two proteins, the co-transporter and the pump protein. How are they thought to work? But before we do that, I want to wrap up channels, because we've been talking about looking at curve one and curve two for each, for cases one, three, and four and five together. What does it look like for two? So let's look at channels for a bit, and then we'll come back and look at the mechanism of these two proteins. If you measure transport through a channel, there are two very obvious features. One is that it's very fast. Maybe I should say there are three. One is that it's second is it's specific, and the third that it doesn't saturate at what people call physiological levels of the thing it transports, which you might call reasonable levels. So as long as you have reasonable levels of X, curve number two looks like this. The more stuff you add, the faster it goes through the channel. And so some people think about channels as a kind of diffusion. Once you put the channel in place, things just diffuse through the channel. The only thing wrong with that is how can they be specific? The fact that channels don't saturate easily and that things move through them very quickly implies that the protein of the channel doesn't interact very much with what goes through it. The protein in the channel doesn't have much in the way of moving parts. If the parts move, they move very slightly. So it's not like an enzyme-substrate interaction to move something through a channel. A channel is relatively inert, and things move in it. But it's clearly not totally inert, or it couldn't be specific. So since it's specific, and only certain things are allowed through, some people think of it as a kind of facilitated diffusion. So the terminology varies for it. But the important part is that it's very hard to saturate a channel because the interaction between X and the channel protein is quite limited. But it's not zilch. Now, we're not going to talk about the mechanism of channels, but there are some references in your notes to how they are thought to work. They are only now being figured out. The most interesting thing about channels, from our point of view, is their regulation. We mentioned earlier that channels, such as the ones in gap junctions, can be gated. They can be selectively closed or open. This is often in response to hormones, but not always. So some channels, if a channel closes or opens in response to a hormone, it's said to be ligand gated. That means the binding of some chemical opens or closes the channel. There's two other kinds of very important gating as well. In addition to chemical gating, some channels are gated by voltage. As we will see, most channels move ions. And so the voltage controls the flow of ions by opening and closing channels. And this is very important. Voltage-gated channels are very important in nerve and muscle in terms of sending signals and of allowing muscle to contract. That involves the movement of ions triggered by voltage. And we won't talk about this now, but we'll talk about this later at some length. And there's the third kind, which are mechanically gated. And these are important, of course, in touch. As you might imagine, that when you touch your skin, you actually do deform channel proteins and cause movement. But in addition, these are involved in balance and hearing, that the sound waves actually open and close channels in your ear, which actually allows you to hear. And if we have time, we'll talk a little about how you pick up the senses using these. Now, some channels are regulated the way GLUT4 is. Remember the aquaporins. Some channels are regulated by inserting them into the appropriate membrane or moving them away. And others remain there all the time but are gated in response to the right stimulus. Now, some channels are open all the time. And one of the interesting questions is, what good is a channel that's open all the time? And I want to discuss a specific example because it illustrates an important point about channels, in particular, ion channels. Most, but not all, channels move ions. Some people, when they say channel, really imply ion channel because that's the major kind. So if a channel moves ions, we have a complication we haven't dealt with at all. We've been considering concentration. You have more X on this side, pushes that away. You have more X on this side of a membrane, it pushes the other way. But if your substance is charged, you know, it isn't just chemical push to worry about. There's also electrical push. You have to consider, is there any voltage or electric potential in the vicinity which is going to push your ions around? So let's consider what should happen. In a particular kind of channel, cells have what are called potassium leak channels. These are channels that are never gated and never closed. What good are they? Well, let's consider what should happen. Put a couple of channels in. Now, what should the potassium be like in the cell to begin with? If we forget about the channels for a minute and we think about what else is going on in a cell, every cell has a sodium-potassium pump. So in every cell, the basal condition is high potassium on the inside relative to the outside. The potassium gradient is higher on the inside than the outside. So if we have these channels that allow specifically potassium to move, Where will the potassium go? Will potassium tend to go in, or will potassium tend to go out? It's going to tend to go out. Will the potassium just all flow out of the cell? If you come back in a while, will the potassium outside equal the potassium inside? Suppose we turn off the pump. We let the pump establish the gradient, and we turn off the pump. No pump. And now we just let the potassium leak. When we reach an equilibrium, rate in equals rate out, will the potassium be the same on both sides? Maybe you should think about that. Why don't you talk about that for a minute? You get 30 seconds. Will it be the same on both sides or not? So we've turned off the pump, and we let those channels rip. So let's take a vote. Is it going to be equal in and out? How many people say yes? People say yes. How many people say no? More people say no. How many people are undecided? A significant number. So let's think this one through. Who says no? Who's willing to volunteer why? Why?
If the potassium ions hang out outside the cell, they might influence the repulsion between the two. It might cause other potassium ions to stay inside the cell rather than deal with the repulsion.
So you're saying repulsion due to what?
The sodium ions that diffuse out but don't...
The potassium.
Potassium ions.
Oh, so what he's saying is what's going to happen is we're going to end up with potassium here, but we're going to end up with some potassium there too. Now, one of the things we didn't put in, is a cell neutral to begin with? Probably yes. So the cell not only has potassium, but this is a little clearer if we also put in some anions. Before we turned off the pump, the cell is approximately neutral due to the positives balancing the negatives. Now, what happens if the potassium starts to leak out? Let's see, we put in three anions, so we need, say, I've got more anions now. I'm going to put one more in here to make it come out even. Okay, so we have four anions and only two potassiums inside, but we have two potassiums outside. Now is the cell neutral on the inside? Notice it's not. It's got an excess of minus on the inside, and there's an excess of plus on the outside. Another way to look at this is, once the ions leak, which way is the chemical push is this way? There's more potassium in than out. It isn't clear here from this picture because I only started with four. But there's such a high concentration of potassium inside that even though some of the potassium leaks out, the chemical push is out. But now, once there are positive ions on the outside, which way is the electrical push? The electrical push is this way. If the minus can't move, but the positive does, if the positive potassium leaks out, we're going to establish a potential difference here across the membrane, or a charge difference. So you're a potassium ion. You're higher inside, so the chemical is pushing you out. But there's this electrical charge, which is repulsing you. As he said, the electrical charge is just trying to push you back in. So what's going to happen is that potassium is going to leak out until the chemical and the electrical pushes are balanced. And the point at which they are balanced, there will be no more net movement. And in fact, this is what happens, and this is responsible primarily for this potential across the membrane. There are other factors, but this is the primary one. Cells generally are slightly negative on the inside relative to the outside. And this difference turns out to be extremely important, even in ordinary cells, but especially in nerve and muscle cells. This is the basis of electrical excitability. Because you can use these differences both in concentration and charge either to do work or to send signals. Are there any questions about this before we return to the model business? Yeah.
Do they use the same channels to leak in and
out? Do you use the same channels to leak in and out? Well, channels, remember, channels allow movement in either direction equally. But it depends on the combination of chemical and electrical push, whether net, the ions are moving one way, or net, the ions are moving the other way, or it's just balanced.
So what's the answer then? Are they equal or what?
Okay, so are they going to be equal? It actually takes, his question is it going to be equal? And the answer is no, because it only takes a little bit of potassium outside to create electrical push, which balances the chemical push from the inside. So once you establish a little bit of a potential gradient or voltage across the membrane, that is sufficient to prevent net leakage outside. So you reach an equilibrium when the potassium inside is much higher than the potassium outside. Even though the holes are open and you would think all the potassium would rush out, it doesn't. Because only enough potassium rushes out to establish a plus on the outside, which pushes back in more potassium. Yeah?
The anions
are fixed because, in general, there are less. Many of the anions are proteins. That's the simple answer, and therefore can't move. They can't get through the carriers. Some anions can move, but there are more. The cations are more mobile than the anions. Yeah.
So it's a constant gradient change, and the concentration will never be equal on the inside.
The concentration will never be equal on the two sides.
It's constantly changing.
Well, the point here is, if you have a neutral chemical and you open a hole, it diffuses until the two sides are equal because the only push is chemical. But if you have an ion and you open a hole, when the ion moves, it establishes a potential gradient that opposes its chemical movement. And so you have to consider the balance between the two. You never reach a static state in any of these. You always have things moving in and things moving out. The question is, when you reach the stage so that the rate in equals the rate out, what are the concentrations on the two sides? And here it won't be equal. Yeah, one more question.
So when you say chemical push, you mean the difference in concentration?
The chemical push is due to the gradient and the difference in concentration. That's correct. The electric push is due to the difference in potential or charge. Now, I want to take the last few minutes to look at handout 5B, which shows a model for how active transport might work in these two mechanisms. Now, there are similar pictures in your texts and online. And I've picked these pictures, though, because they illustrate what the basic features are that we have to keep in mind. So if we look first at the sodium-potassium pump, which is on the top, you notice that there are two forms of the protein, which are called E1 and E2. This is traditionally just what they're called. And these differ in their relative affinities for sodium and potassium. So one picks up sodium preferentially, one picks up potassium. In this case, also, one faces in and one faces out. So that when the protein is facing one way, it prefers one ion, which it then flips and carries in. When it's facing the other way, it prefers the other ion. So it dumps the first one and picks up the other one. So when you go in, when you go out this way, you're going to dump what? What goes out of the cell is sodium. So you're going to pick up sodium on this side, and all this is written down on the handout, that the affinity for sodium is high on this side and low on this side, and vice versa for potassium. So when the cell, when the protein is facing in, it picks up sodium and dumps potassium. When the protein is facing out, it dumps whatever sodium it had and picks up potassium. And then it flips and brings it in. Now, remember we said that phosphorylating a protein can change its conformation, its shape, or its activity. That's what's operating here. What is triggering the protein to turn to the other side is, in fact, either phosphorylation of the protein or removal of the phosphate. So there are two enzymes here, and the enzymes are part of the pump. There is a kinase which adds a phosphate, so this is the phosphorylated form, and there is a phosphatase that takes it off. And the phosphatase and the kinase and the binding sites for the ions are all part of this complicated protein or pump. So the way it would work is, let's say over here, the protein's facing, let's try it here, the protein is pacing in. When it binds sodium and dumps potassium, that causes some change in the protein, which activates the kinase. So the kinase then splits ATP. And adds that phosphate to the enzyme itself. The addition of the phosphate flips the protein. The protein is now facing out. It also has a low affinity for sodium, so whatever sodium it's carrying, it dumps. It has a high affinity for potassium, so it picks it up. Then the binding of the potassium triggers the phosphatase activity of the pump, which cuts off the phosphate. That restores the protein to its previous state, facing in. And now it lets go of the potassium because it has a low affinity for potassium, picks up sodium, and the cycle repeats. So this is sort of like you have a protein. And remember with the glucose carrier, it could just face either way. Or you have the rocking banana, faces either way. This protein, when it faces this way, it looks like that. When it faces this way, it looks like that. So it has two forms, and one always faces one way, and one always faces the other way. Now, the sodium-potassium pump, the sodium-glucose co-transport also is a protein with two forms, with two different affinities for glucose. But the difference is, it's thought that either form can face either way. So it's like this. It has two forms, which can face the inside, or it has two forms that can face the outside. But it has two forms, and they can go either way. And in this case, binding sodium opens it up, so now it can bind glucose. And once it has both of them, it flips. Then it lets go of the sodium. Why would it let go of sodium inside a cell? Why would it tend to bind sodium on the outside and let it go on the inside? What's the concentration of sodium like on the outside versus the inside of a cell? Remember, the sodium is very high on the outside. The affinity of the enzyme for sodium is the same all the time. But because there's high sodium on the outside, it tends to pick it up. When it's facing the inside, it tends to let it go. So the sodium on the outside opens it up and it picks up glucose. Once it has both, it flips. Now, once you're inside, sodium concentration is low, sodium diffuses off. But now the affinity for glucose is low, so it loses the glucose. And then you start over again. So that's written on the bottom half of your handout. The diagram is quite similar. We've called them the A form and the B form. And this one has the affinity for glucose high. This one has the affinity for glucose low. Now, the difference here is that what triggers it is the binding of sodium. So if you're on the outside of the cell, the sodium concentration is high. And if you're on the inside of the cell, the sodium concentration is low. Now, probably either of these can bind sodium, but the point is that the only place you're going to get sodium is on the outside of the cell. So once you bind sodium, you're going to have the high glucose affinity one. And once you've got both glucose and sodium, it flips to the inside. But what happens to the sodium? So this one actually is going to have sodium on it. But what happens to the sodium once you get inside the cell? The sodium diffuses away because the sodium's low inside the cell. So the sodium now diffuses away. And now the glucose falls off because once the sodium's lost, and in your picture I've dumped the sodium on this side, which might be better. Once the sodium comes off, the protein becomes the A form and dumps its glucose. If it's facing outside, it picks up sodium and therefore can pick up glucose. If it's facing inside, it tends to lose sodium and therefore it loses glucose. This protein could be used to move glucose into a cell or out of a cell, but it's always used to move it in. Why is that? In a test tube, it'll do it either way. Why is that? In a cell, the sodium is always higher outside and lower inside. So the protein always, when it's the A form, it's always inside, and when it's the B form, it's always outside. But in a test tube, you can reverse the concentration of sodium and get it to move glucose in the other direction. There is no way you can get ATP to move potassium out and sodium in. Now, we've talked about the mechanisms of all of these various modes of transport. And now the question is, what are they good for? We've already mentioned that glucose-sodium co-transport is used to get the glucose into these cells. It turns out that carrier-mediated transport gets it out. Diffusion gets it into the red blood, into the bloodstream, etc. Now, all of this is diagrammed on 5A, so bring that back next time, and we'll go over it quickly to put all the parts together, and then go on to how you move large molecules around.